And then for the monarchy to realize that reforms are important. Because if not, then I think the protesters have their legitimate right to look for other alternatives. Even that alternative could mean abolition of the monarchy altogether.
Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Leo Kamer. In September of this year, Thailand's Constitutional Court ruled that the country's Prime Minister, Prayut Chan-o-cha, can remain in office despite the end of his 8-year term. In this episode, we discuss Thailand's move toward authoritarianism, the role of the monarchy and other institutions in the country's political network, and the recent protest movements which have arisen within the country. In order to explain the political situation in Thailand, joining me today is Dr. Pavin Chachawampongpong. Pavin is the editor-in-chief of the Kyoto Review of Southeast Asia and associate professor at the Center for Southeast Asia Studies at Kyoto University. The Kyoto Review carries articles translated into English, Thai, Bahasa Indonesia, Filipino, Vietnamese, and Japanese. Pavin is also an activist and critic of the Thai monarchy, and he has even been threatened with imprisonment. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Pavin, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Hey, thank you so much for the invitation.
Thailand's Constitutional Court recently permitted Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha to remain in his position, even though August 2022 would have marked the end of the constitutional 8-year term. This comes after years of efforts from the military-aligned government to centralize power around itself after taking power through a coup in 2014. We wanted to begin our conversation by discussing the military coup 8 years ago. What caused it, and why was it successful?
Well, the military staged a coup in 2014, and I did mention a number of times that this time it was not just another military coup. So I just would like to remind the listener here that Thailand have had more than 20 coups since 1932, that when we abolished absolute monarchy. So we have held the record of having the most military coups in Southeast Asia, and I think perhaps we top three in the world. But when I say that this is not just another military coup, because we have to look into political context at the time. Previously, Thailand was ruled by this enigmatic figure under King Bhumibol Adulyadej, who had been on the throne since 1946. Even though we talk about Thailand as being a constitutional monarchy, but in fact, the monarchy had had a special role, if not authoritative role, you know, in sort of dominating Thai politics. So in other words, even though we have a democratic government, but the role of the monarchy was very important, if not anything, if anything, so it, as I said, dominating Thai politics. But by the year 2014, we started to see the decline of the Bhumibol era. So the analysis here is that the institutions surrounding the military, the institutions surrounding the monarchy, including the military, fear that it would lose legitimizing force. It would lose control of Thai politics because of the decline of the Bhumibol power. Because of that, it decided to stage a coup. And once again, in 2014, in order to ensure that the royal succession would go smoothly, that the power would still be in the hand of the traditional elite. So, because of that, 2014 was a coup that was so related to the royal succession at the time. And never forget that the government back then was under Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra. Now, Yingluck is the sister of Thaksin Shinawatra. And Thaksin Shinawatra, you know, if I'm not exaggerating it, you know, he is the most powerful prime minister, you know, since 1932, even if he was driven into exile, in 2006. Indeed, he was also overthrown in a military coup in 2006 as well. But his influence in politics has been so immense. And Yingluck Shinawatra sort of succeeded that kind of political influence. So in 2014, not only the military wanted to ensure that it would control the royal succession, it also wanted to overthrow yet another powerful prime minister. Overthrowing Yingluck Shinawatra. So basically, killing two birds with one bullet, something like that. So this is a kind of an understanding behind the coup of 2014. How could it be so successful? Because I do not believe that the military work alone in taking control of politics. And never forget also that there are so many other institutions that have taken advantage from the monarchy, not just the military. We are talking about the judiciary, we are talking about the police, big businesses, and also a lot of bureaucrats within the Thai system that have invested their interest in the monarchy. So they all see the benefit of the military taking control of politics through military coup, and that's why they all supported the coup of 2014. And once again, that's why the coup in 2014 was so successful. It was so successful that not only Prayut would be able to appoint himself as prime minister, but when they called for an election in 2019, the pro-junta political party, Palang Pasharat, was able to form a government in 2019. And once again, invited Prayut back to the premiership until today. So,
mm-hmm. So yes, you've mentioned that it wasn't just a regular military coup. It had the support of all of these institutions that had something to gain. And so I was wondering, after the military coup happened, what measures did the military junta and all these institutions that supported it, what measures did they take to consolidate power around themselves?
Well, there are a number of ways that they have done so in order to consolidate, their power position in Thai politics. Let's do it in terms of legal measures. In terms of legal measures, as always, after military coup, they often threw away the previous constitution, and often they rewrite a new constitution. In fact, Thailand had lived with so many constitutions. I often make joke with my students, both in Thailand and in Japan, that whereas the United States has only one constitution, in Thailand we have multiple constitutions. If we talk about 20 something military coups, Thailand could have had sort of 20 constitution as well. And every time the constitution was rewritten, the people who behind the rewriting of the constitution wanted to make sure that it would lend the benefit, to the elites rather than the people. Okay. For example, after the coup 2006, we had a new constitution written in 2007. And yet again, it was thrown away. When after the coup 2014, then we have a new constitution some years later after 2014. The new feature of the current constitution, maybe it's not really a new feature, it's basically some old tactic, but being reused once again, that when they stated that all the members of the Senate can be appointed, right? So this sort of how to say backdated, the Thai political development, because I'm sorry, I'm to have to give you all this context, but it is very essential. This is because 1997 we had a new constitution, and 1997 constitution was considered the most democratic constitution of all time. One of the features of that constitution is that all this member of the Senate have to be elected. That was in 1997. But after the coup of 2014, once again, we moved back to pre-1997 constitution when all the members of the Senate can be appointed. Why this is so important? Because the military or the political elite wanted to make sure that members of the upper house would always be supportive of the government. So and any other effort, including the amendment of the constitution, would be so impossible. You know, because the upper house will always block any attempt, you know, to for the opposition to propose the amendment of the constitution. So, well, I mean, going back to how they have consolidated their power, one of the things was the rewriting of the constitution that would ensure the staying power of the current regime, right? Apart from that, you know, they also use some social measure outside the framework of the parliament. You know, big businesses continue to support the monarchy, the military, supporting them financially. So, I mean, this is something that not really unusual in the Thai context, but it could be very unusual in any other developed country. It is, I mean, when you look into Thailand, you know, you would see that, you know, big businesses always line up to donate money, you know, to the military, to the monarchy. This is one way of them not only to show support for the regime, but also in order to ensure that, you know, they would buy their way, you know, into their powerful position, not just only politically, but also economically. So it would not go wrong, basically, to befriend the establishment, especially in donating a lot of money, so to ensure that their businesses, you know, would also be protected by the traditional elite. Other things would also be, you know, supporters of the military, of the monarchy, you know, continue to protect them. In the meantime, declaring war against, you know, opponents. One of the way that they use basically is the usage of lese majeste law or Article 112 of the criminal code. Now, Article 112 states that any insults against the monarchy could be, you know, anyone insulting the monarchy could be imprisoned up to 15 years. So, I mean, this is a way of them trying to silence critics of the monarchy. It has been used, you know, so frequently. I myself also a victim of Article 112 too. So, I mean, to sum up, you know, there are many different ways for a supporter of the current regime to use different tactics in order to consolidate their political power.
And that point you mentioned about what almost to me seems like a patronage system where big businesses donate money to the military and the monarchy to ensure that they have influence and they support each other. How do you think that has affected Thai politics?
Well, I mean, Thai politics is a big, large network. You know, anyone who interested in Thai politics must have known by now that, you know, there has been some, you know, thorough study of the Thai political domain, of the Thai political landscape, that, you know, the best way to look at Thai politics is to look at it as a kind of political network. And the most powerful political network, you know, from the 1960s, 1970s, up to at least 2001, that was the year when Thaksin Shinawat became prime minister. This has been network monarchy. So network monarchy basically putting the monarchy on top of the political structure in Thailand, surrounded by, you know, key institutions. So one of the key players in this network has been big businesses. So big businesses, they invested so much in the monarchy. And because of their wealth, you know, not only they supported financially the monarchy and the military, they also sort of have some say in politics. So, I mean, the most evident way would be that, you know, any policy that come out of the current regime would always benefit big business in Thailand rather than benefit, you know, smaller people. You know, today when you look into the Thai economy, you would see that it had been dominated by really just a few big business in Thailand. For example, you're talking about Jalern Prokapan or CP, right? You're talking about Siam Cement, which also have had some, you know, joint investment with the Crown Property Bureau. Now, Crown Property Bureau is used to be a state institution under the wing of the monarchy. But from 2017-2018, all assets under the Crown Property Bureau have been transferred into the sole possession of the current king, King Vacharongkorn. So in other words, you know, the king has taken control of the state institution, the Crown Property Bureau. He is now the 100% owner of the Crown Property Bureau, making him the richest monarch in the world. So there are some private businesses that also have some kind of investment with the Crown Property Bureau. So it just like it become sort of automatic for them to always befriend the monarchy. You know, you can't afford, you know, to compete with the monarchy or with the Crown Property Bureau. So, you know, looking from this perspective, you would see this tight connection between big businesses and also, you know, the monarchy, the military, and it just becomes so inseparable between political and economic interests among these players.
All right, so we've laid the groundwork sort of with the structure of the government since the 2014 coup, how it's changed, how it altered the constitution since the 1997 democratic one, or more democratic one, that is. But then it faces the challenge which all governments have faced, which was the COVID-19 pandemic. And since 2020, we've seen political unrest and protests due to a lacking economic recovery from the pandemic, as well as failures in responding to the disease itself. What have been these protesters' aims? Are the protests expressions of anger toward Prayut, the government as a whole, or something else entirely?
Well, I think that the breakout of the protests in 2020, and I have to emphasize that it was led by the younger generation, right? So this is something that we never seen before, you know, in Thai modern political history. You might be able to mention that, you know, COVID-19 had some role to play, or in other words, you know, sort of being a driving force behind the protests of 2020 by the younger generation. But I don't think COVID in itself is really the only source of discontentment among the protesters. Yes, it is true that the government sort of very slow in responding, you know, to the COVID crisis. But again, never forget that right at the beginning, Thailand was among only a few countries that had some good record, you know, when it comes to dealing with the issue of COVID-19. So what I'm trying to say is that it might play some role, but the real reason behind the protest of 2020, and it started first in February 2020, that was when one opposition party under the name of Future Forward Party was ordered by the Constitutional Court, you know, to be disbanded, play some role, you know, behind the protest of 2020. But I like to emphasize here that the real reason for the protest in 2020, and in fact it started in February, that was because after the one opposition party, the Future Food Party, was ordered by the Constitutional Court, you know, to be disbanded. So under an allegation that its leader Thanathorn Chungrungrungkit lending his own money, you know, to finance his political party, and because of that, it went against the the political party law, something like that. But everyone in Thailand knows that this is not the real reason. The real reason was because the Future Forward Party was the only party which offer progressive platform. And one of the policies of this party was basically to reform the military, and in bracket, to reform the monarchy as well. And because of that, you know, the traditional elite felt that they were threatened by this party. And again, because of that, you know, the Constitutional Court intervened to order a dissolution of this party. The younger generation went so mad, went so angry about it, because yet again, you know, this is because of the interference of the extra constitutional, extra parliamentary, you know, institution in trying to control Thai politics, and to voice their anger. So they took to the street in Bangkok and protest against the dissolution of the Future Forward Party. I think that was the main reason for the first outbreak of the protest in February 2020. But once again, yes, COVID sort of stood in the backdrop, you know, but the real reason has been the dissolution of the Future Forward Party. But COVID once again came back after that. And because of the COVID pandemic, that's why the protest had to stop. The protest came back though in June, July, 2020, right? And I think once again there was another turning point, you know, in Thai politics. Partly, this round of protest was inspired or motivated by the abduction of one young dissident who had run away from Thai law, you know, after 2014 coup, and residing in Phnom Penh, the capital of Cambodia. So he has been critic of the military. He was abducted, you know, right in front of his apartment in Phnom Penh in broad daylight, and the abduction was captured by CCTV. So and then he was forcibly disappeared. Up until now, we never know his whereabouts. Presumably, he was killed. So, I mean, this once again drove the younger generation to go on the street. And this time, the younger generation came up with the most daring agenda. And this agenda was to propose an immediate royal reform. Now, there was a link between the abduction of this young guy. His name is Wan Chalom. So because someone considered Wan Chalom as being one of the critics of the monarchy, and to abduct a critic of the monarchy, the younger generation or the younger protester in Thailand try to tie things together. So, and then put a blame on the military, on the monarchy. And that's why one of the demands for royal reform is basically for the government to investigate into the abduction and killing of Thai dissident overseas. But the investigation of the abduction is only one among many demands. Other demands for the royal reform, including for the monarchy to stop intervening in politics, for the monarchy to stop, you know, 24-hour propaganda, you know, for the king to return the money or return the Crown Property Bureau to the state, and also the abolition of Lese Majeste law. So there's a lot of things on the plate. But to answer your question, this has been the main motivations behind the protest in 2020. First, from the dissolution of the Future Forward Party. Second, it is about the abduction of a young dissident in Cambodia.
All right. And so, yes, one of the target of the dissenters has been the monarchy, and there have been calls for monarchical reform. And you, for example, launched the Royalist Marketplace Facebook group, which accrued over 1 million users and became a place where users could freely criticize the monarchy. And you mentioned various royal reforms that people wanted. And King Rama X, since taking power in 2016, has moved to increase his power, including more rigorous enforcement of those Lese Majeste laws that prohibit insults toward the king. is this opposition to the king or the monarchy separate from opposition to the ruling government as a whole? Or is it because they're part of the same interconnected system that the target is one and the same?
Yeah, I mean, this question is, how to say, is very complex. I will talk about royalist marketplace a little bit later. But just go back to the last point you made. Well, I mean, whether there would be a connection between, anti-monarchist movement and also the opposition which operate within the parliamentary system. But first thing first, you know, even to mention anti-monarchist movement is very dangerous in Thailand, because anyone who has been branded anti-monarchist would already been perceived as committing, you know, lèse majesté. So I would not want to call the current movement in Thailand as anti-monarchist movement. Simply because I do not want to put, you know, the protester in Thailand, you know, in jeopardy. And I think, you know, there's other different way to call this kind of movement. I would say that this movement is basically strive, you know, to push for reform of the monarchy rather than to be an anti-monarchist. I'm sorry, I have to make this position clear. Now, looking at the dynamic between the movement on the street and also the opposition, on the surface, you see that these two actors, you know, working separately. And this is simply because the opposition continue to be mindful of how they would be perceived, you know, by their opponents. They do not want to get too close to the protester on the street. Otherwise, they would be accused of, you know, inciting the protest, and also even including inciting violence on the street committed by the protester. And even more importantly, they do not want to see what want to be perceived as being a part of anti-monarchist movement. So that's why on the surface, you know, you see that protesters have been left alone, and then opposition party just doing their own work, right? And then doing their own work, I have to say that they do not do good enough work because whatever the people on the street try to propose to the government, including royal reform, you know, if this would happen, you know, in any other country, the opposition party would be able to take the demand of the people into the parliamentary system. But in the Thai case, the opposition could not do it because they could not even talk about royal reform inside the parliament. Otherwise, they would be accused of lèse majesté. So that's why the situation in Thailand is just very awkward. It's very complex that, you know, even though the opposition may want to help the protester, even though they could use, you know, the parliamentary, instrument, but in fact they could not, because everyone so careful of their position. They do not want, once again, they do not want to be perceived as being a part of the anti-monarchist movement, right? But okay, that was on the surface. Well, from behind the scene, it might be something a little different. And I know this because I have been talking to core protesters on the street and also some core leaders, you know, of the opposition party. Of course, there have been some kind of support, you know, from the opposition party toward the protester, especially, you know, the former Future Forward Party. Now they have a new name because the old party was disbanded. So the rest of the member of the party came up with a new party called Move Forward Party. Now, I have to say that Move Forward Party has played some behind-the-scenes role in supporting the protester. For example, you know, when the kids on the street, when they were arrested because of their participation in the protest, some MPs, member of parliament from the Move Forward Party would go out there and help them, especially in calling for bail or applying for bail for them, using their MP position to guarantee that, you know, this kid would not run away. So I think this would be a kind of help that we get from Move Forward Party. And in some way, it show a kind of connection between the opposition party and the protester on the street. Even though this might not be a formal one, but yet, you know, I think the kids on the street somehow appreciate the help, this kind of help coming from the Move Forward Party as well.
Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about the beginnings of the protests and how it's materialized in 2020. But now in 2022, we've had this recent court decision that ruled that Prayut's tenure legally began with his victory in the 2019 election, not with the 2014 coup, meaning his constitutional 8-year term would end in 2027 instead of 2022, as many thought it should have. This would allow Prayut to run in next year's elections. How have the Thai people, as well as the opposition parties, reacted to the extension of Prayut's tenure?
Well, I mean, it's sad to say that even though a lot of Thai people, including myself, you know, become so angry because of the verdict of the Constitutional Court. And we know, you know, deep in our heart that this is once again the work of the network monarchy, you know, the interference of the Constitutional Court, basically to protect the interests of the political elite, right? But when I say that, it is sad to say it, because even though we were angry about the decision, but it has become normalized. So in other words, you know, even prior to the verdict of the Constitutional Court, a lot of Thai knew how it's going to turn out to be. And exactly this is how it turned out to be, that the court ruled in favor of Prayut, that Prayut, you know, could continue to be in the premiership until at least 2027. So, but then what else could we do? When you talk about, you know, when the political elite continue to dominate Thai politics with little chance, you know, for the opposition and also, you know, for the protest to return to the street, you know, to come out and to restructure Thai politics, we have little chance. So some people might think that, okay, maybe the next election could be a new chance for us. I don't know. I'm not excited about it. And simply because, you know, we have not been able to amend the constitution. So in other words, the next election should it be held sometime next year, it would be held under the same political condition, under the same constitutional condition. And that means, you know, the elites, the military and those supporting the military, you know, including Palang Pacharat, would continue to take benefit, you know, or advantage out of the current constitution. And I mean, it is also possible that they could come back after the election. So that's why I'm not excited about it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it seems like you think that the elections, you know, they may happen and seem fair on the surface, but the constitutional reforms that happened in 2017 would mean that really it's not a truly democratic election. But I'm wondering, how much support does Palang Pacharat have compared to the opposition among the Thai people? Do you have any idea? Because it's so hard to come out in public and support the opposition, I would assume. So do you have any idea what the relative size of each faction is, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I could only say this, you know, based on the outcome of the previous election, right? So of course, you know, we can talk about election, the last election being fraud. It could also happen, you know, just Thailand, just like any other developing country, that, you know, to talk about truly free and fair election, you know, might be sort of imaginary. But okay, let's assume that, you know, the result of the previous election more or less accurate. So you would also see that Palang Pacharat came second. So, I mean, in fact, this is not really bad, you know, for a terrible non-democratic political party to come second. So what did it tell us? It tells us that that number, that's a large number of eligible voters who continue to see that, you know, voting for the pro-monarchy faction would be beneficial for them. So I would assume that, you know, this type of voter may concentrate in, you know, in the urban area, like in Bangkok or in key, you know, or big provinces in Thailand, which all have always been dominated by, you know, the rich, the powerful, that continue to see the monarchy as a sort of, you know, legitimizing force, you know, for themselves. And I don't think these people would go away anytime soon. You could also see that, you know, these people can call themselves as royalists. And usually royalists, they are quite vocal. So, I mean, in the past, we're talking about the conflict in Thailand divided by colors, red and yellow, right? On basically red, you know, representing pro-democracy force, yellow basically representing royalists. This day, we no longer talk about red and yellow, but we're talking about basically pro-monarchy and anti-monarchy. And I like to say that pro-monarchy or royalists, there are a large number of them also. And it is likely that these people would continue to vote for the Palang Pacharat. So in other words, you know, I would not be surprised, you know, if these people continue to vote for Palang Pacharat. And I would not be surprised either that Palang Pacharat possibly could win, you know, majority even if it would be slim majority, right? Now, but on the other hand, you know, the opposition party could also win this time too. I'm not talking so much about the Move Forward Party because of the two progressive agenda, talking about, you know, the reform of the monarchy of the military, and because of that, it might scare a lot of people off. But I'm talking about the pro-Thaksin faction. I'm talking about the Phuea Thai Party. Now, the Phuea Thai Party came first in the last election, but was unable to form the government because of the uncertainty, you know, to form coalition government, and because of that, it sort of paved the way for Palang Pacharat to form the government instead. But never forget that Phuea Thai win a one first in the last election. It could win again this time. I'm not sure whether it could win landslide. I doubt that it would win landslide, but it might still be possible for the Phuea Thai Party to win majority. When I say I doubt it would not win landslide, because Thaksin Shinawatra, you know, continue to be influential in Thai politics, even when he's still sitting in Dubai, you know, in his exile home. Thaksin tried to come back to politics in the past year, you know, with his regular appearance in Clubhouse. So he basically has his program on Clubhouse every Tuesday. But lately, you know, I mean, even though he's in the opposition party, you know, he continued to express more and more and more of his pro-monarchy position. You know, people talk about this is because Thaksin want to return home and want to reconcile with the monarchy. That's why, you know, Thaksin say nice thing about the monarchy. Whatever he said, for example, he said something like, the kid, you know, on the street, you know, they knew so little about the contribution of the monarchy, you know, to Thailand. Had they known that the royal family has contributed so much, they would not have gone onto the street. And he also made another controversial statement. He said that lèse majesté law in itself is not a problem. The people who violated the law basically is the problem, you know, in themselves. So this kind of controversial message sort of alienated him from the younger generation. And this is why I said that Thaksin parties could still win, but might not get support from the younger generation. So it will not win landslide. But even if Thaksin win and Thaksin party win and can form a government, with Thaksin attitude right now being so pro-monarchy, then what hope that we have, you know, for Thailand to move forward toward reform of the monarchy? Should Thaksin party be in power after the election. I'm not excited once again.
Okay, so to finish us off, I'll throw that last question back at you maybe. What hope is there for monarchy reform, if any, and how could that happen?
Oh my God, this is $1 million, I have to say. Well, I mean, since the protests in 2020 and with the demand for royal reform, we have heard nothing. We have got no responses from King Vajiralongkorn. So in other words, you know, the king is not interested in reform. I mean, should this happen in a normal society, you know, when the people, you know, call upon the monarchy to do such and such, at least there should be a kind of communication or dialogue between the monarchy and the people. I could not imagine that this would happen in the UK, you know, when people become so upset, you know, about certain things that the monarchy do, and then the monarchy sort of basically ignore them. No, I would not imagine, right? But this happened in Thailand, and this showed that the monarchy could not care less about what the people think about, you know, its roles and its position. So to answer your question, I do not see any prospect whatsoever that the monarchy would come to the realization that reforms are important if the monarchy is to survive into, you know, the future. So what leave us then, the Thai people? What leave the kid once again on the kids on the street, you know, to go ahead with this agenda of, you know, monarchic reform? So I talked to a lot of them. Now they seem to believe that to go ahead with, you know, pushing for the reform of the monarchy, it might be impossible. So if it would be impossible, they might sort of upgrade, you know, their demand. So they started to talk about other alternatives aside from the constitutional monarchy. So in other words, they start to talk about the possibility of republicanism in Thailand. Talking about republicanism in Thailand is less majestic because then you want to overthrow the monarchy. So again, it's a dilemma for the protester, for the younger generation. They realize that, you know, to call for the reform of the monarchy is could be impossible. But at the same time, to go and support republicanism in Thailand, you know, it could be illegal for them too. But after all, what would be the hope then, you know, to answer your question? I think the ball is now in the court of the monarchy. Should they realize that, I mean, should they, when I said they, I mean the whole entity of the network monarchy, including the monarchy, should they realize that they want to survive, right? They have to, I can't stress enough, they have to reform. If not, they are destroying themselves. Because I could not imagine Thailand would go on, continue to be in this state. I don't think how Thailand could move forward and become a normal society had the monarchy not being under constitution. Or otherwise, Thailand could move ahead and become something else, like become a Republic of Thailand, which again is an equally, you know, daunting task to do so. So I just hope that, you know, both sides of the political divide, you know, could make a kind of dialogue. And then for the monarchy to realize that reforms are important. Because if not, then I think the protesters have their legitimate right to look for other alternatives. Even that alternative could mean abolition of the monarchy altogether.
Well, that's a challenging road ahead for pro-democracy activists and protesters. Thank you very much for coming on, Pavan. This was a very interesting episode.
Thank you so much, Leo, for the invitation.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.